Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, Muslim and Christian religious leaders gather in Lebanon to discuss the fruits of Pope Benedict XVI's recent visit to the region. We talked to one of the Christian organizers of that visit about his hopes for the Pope's message of peace and coexistence between faith communities in the Middle East. And this week marked World Maritime Day, a moment to reflect on safety at sea that coincides this year with two infamous maritime tragedies. Lebanon's Muslim and Christian religious leaders gathered this week to discuss the fruits of Pope Benedict XVI's recent pastoral visit to that country. During his September 14th through 16th visit, the Pope presented the bishops of the Middle East the apostolic exhortation concluding their synod of 2010. Besides taking part in a joyful youth gathering and huge outdoor mass in the searing Beirut heat, the Pope also met church leaders from the region, as well as Muslim faith and political leaders. Well, in this week's meeting at the Catholic Maronite Patriarchate of Bekirke, just north of Beirut, Muslims and Christians said they viewed the papal visit as desiring to confirm Lebanon as a land of dialogue and peaceful interaction among the different cultures that live, the richness of diversity. In a communique, they committed to spreading the fraternal message that the Pope brought with him and to reflect further on its content in families, in schools, and in society. They also agreed to transmit the Pope's message to faith leaders in other Arab nations.
It has been very predominantly positive.
Well, I was in Lebanon covering the papal trip for Vatican Radio and went to Bekirke after the Pope had returned to Rome. I spoke with the Vicar General of the Patriarchate, Archbishop Paul Saya, who told me the visit was immensely popular among people of all faiths and ethnicities in Lebanon. While the outdoor mass on Beirut's waterfront September 16th drew upwards of 350,000 people, almost 30,000 young people, Christians and Muslims, crammed into the Bekirke Patriarchate Square to celebrate an evening of prayer, song and dance with Pope Benedict.
It was simply a wonderful experience to see those young people so enthusiastic and so full of life. Remember, those people were here starting, you know, at least 6 hours ahead of the event. They were lively. They were the Lebanese youth, all the factions, all the colors. There were some Muslims as well as Christians. And so it tells you that our young people are very hungry of being together, being who they are, without their political tags, without their religious tags, you know, just to be there, to enjoy each other, and show their sheer joy, you know, to be in the presence of the Pope, and also to work together. I mean, there was a tremendous amount of work done. This is the atmosphere that was prevailing, and I think this is wonderful. And this should tell everybody, the church, the political leaders, and the parents, to make sure, allow those young people to be what they want to be, to bring them together as much as possible. Of course, they each one may have his or her political affiliation, but give them a chance simply to live together, to be together, and to forget for some time political differences that people have. And I think this visit was an excellent opportunity for them to do that. Not only during the visit, but during the preparation for the visit, you know, which was a very, very good bonding experience. And now we're thinking of a yearly event with the youth in Kirkia. Now, after this success, they're saying, why not have something every year? Not at the same scale, of course. And our patriarch is very enthusiastic about it.
One of the things to impress me most was how all of Lebanon's political and religious leaders came together to make Pope Benedict's visit to their country a huge success, overcoming divisions and diffusing often fiery political rhetoric to show a unified country at a time when the region seems to be falling apart all around. I asked Archbishop Paul how he thought Muslims in Lebanon had reacted to this visit by the leader of the Catholic Church. So many Muslim political and religious leaders also contributed to making this a very successful event.
They were really enthusiastic about it, and they wanted it to be a success. And they were banking on it being a success. I'm sure, you know, they were impressed, you know, and they were happy with the outcome. And as I said, the telephone calls we got from all over were very, very encouraging, the emails and so on.
I found it very moving myself, watching the images on television of the Pope saying farewell to these Muslim leaders at the airport, he holding their hands in his, and I just found it a very moving moment.
It was. I don't know if you noticed on the way in, Muslim girls and ladies and people were lined up quite along the road. And on the way to the presidential palace also, there were many Muslim groups in the audience, especially young people. You could see the ladies dressed in Muslim, you know, outfits and veil and everything. And you could see young people with pancards, you know, that was clearly signed, you know, Maqasid and some other Muslim organizations. No, I think the participation of the Muslims, both at the official as well as the popular level, was very good and genuine. You know, I could feel it at the airport, the Pope speaking to them, as you were saying. You know, they were really, they were genuine in their wanting to be there and wanting to show this real unity in Lebanon, you know, despite all the problems we have, you know, but at least I think there was a show of solidarity among all the Lebanese in receiving the Pope.
What do you see this trip having contributed to coexistence among Christians and Muslims here in this country, and hopefully spreading this message, as Pope John Paul II would have called Lebanon, spreading it beyond Lebanon?
You know, the very fact that, first of all, they stopped the demonstrations. I think this is a positive thing. I wish the demonstrations didn't take place even after the visit of the Pope. But this was, I think, a positive gesture on their part, the part of the leadership of the Muslim community.
To halt demonstrations during the papal visit.
Exactly. They halted demonstrations against this famous anti-Muslim film, you know, that came out.
Do you think this message of unity, of coexistence, goes beyond Lebanon?
I should hope so, and I think it will. I think it will. I think everybody in the region is longing for peace, longing for this Arab awakening to lead to some different way of being, a different way for the communities to relate to each other. And I think looking at Lebanon, you know, they will certainly, I think, you know, feel that this is the way. And we are convinced, again, with all the ups and downs, you know, that one goes through, I think for the Arab Spring, for those countries where you have different religions, different ethnicities, that's the only way through. You have to share power, you have to respect each other, you have to try to be as secular as possible in the positive sense. If they're going to go back to having Islam as the religion of the state in countries like Egypt or Tunisia or Libya or anywhere, and I think they would be back to square one. So I do think that the example of Lebanon during the visit of the Pope, and on the whole, people are more ready now to take it because they're looking for a way out of this mess that many countries are in now after the Arab Awakening. And I don't think they have much choice, you know, if they want to really live in a democratic environment. They have to live together, respect each other, share the power, and allow people to be what they want to be.
So you think that this message of freedom of religion, of freedom of conscience here in the Middle East, this message that Pope Benedict was bringing with him here to Lebanon, that will in some way be espoused?
I think freedom of religion, yes, more than freedom of conscience. I think freedom of conscience will still remain a problem in many, if not most, of the Arab countries, especially where they still think of Islam as being the religion of the state. Now, freedom of religion, we hope it will be less problematic.
But, for example, here in Lebanon, if a Muslim wanted to change his faith and convert to Christianity, is that accepted?
Well, in Lebanon, yes. We have, first of all, by law, it's accepted. Lebanon, as you know, is a secular country. We don't have a religion for the state. Yes, the freedom of conscience in Lebanon is guaranteed. People who want to change their religion, they can, of course. Even when people marry with a person from another faith, say a Christian marrying a Muslim or a Muslim marrying a Christian, both have the choice to remain where they are and live and accept each other and agree on how they want to raise their children. Agree together. But Lebanon is the only country in the Middle East where you have this freedom of conscience. And even in Lebanon, in some very remote areas, some Muslims would find it difficult to accept it. But I mean, it's accepted officially in Lebanon, so there's no problem that way.
Tell me about plans for the Patriarch going off to the new Evangelization Synod in October. Is he going to be bringing something with him to those discussions?
Well, of course, he will not be going alone, and he will bring with him the concerns of the Christians of the Middle East, Christians of Lebanon, of course, but our patriarch, Shararai, is the president of the Council of Patriarchs for the Middle East, so he has a role beyond the Mennonite Church and beyond Lebanon. He certainly will be bringing the concerns, and will be bringing the experiences also, because each region or each church has a way of perceiving evangelization and how to do it, most effectively. That way, I think he will make a contribution, especially now, again, with the situation of the Christians in the Middle East, which is a very difficult situation. Evangelizing our people now is all the more urgent because our people are going through huge problems in all the countries of the Middle East. In Iraq, you know what happened to them. In Syria now, things are very bad. In Egypt, you know how it is. So we have a new reality in the Middle East, and we have to deal with that new reality. How do you offer Jesus Christ? How do we offer the gospel to those troubled people, you know, the people who are very iffy about what's going on, what's going to happen to them, and the future? You're dealing with a very troubled society, you know. I think the patriarch will be sensitizing the synod to this new reality that the Christians of the Middle East are experiencing at the moment.
It is a dramatic moment for the Middle East. It has been since we saw the war in Iraq. How do you bring a new evangelization to people who are fleeing violence, who are fleeing economic problems here, who can't find jobs?
Well, of course, this is the million-dollar question. This is a huge, big challenge. But I think you have to start dealing with the immediate and most urgent needs of the people. And this is what the church has been trying to do in Lebanon with the refugees coming from Syria. I think if you bring Jesus Christ to those people, you have to bring you have to bring the loving Christ, you have to bring the caring Christ. And this comes in all sorts of ways. It comes through the presence of the church close to those people. It comes through offering them what they need. It comes through also helping them rediscover their own commitment as Christians. One of the great things about Christianity is that you have to learn to trust in God. I think this is a vital dimension in Christian faith. You have to surrender yourself to God. If we can get this message across to them, I think this will give them some hope, while at the same time being present to them spiritually, economically, psychologically. I think this is probably the way. At this time, you know, when, as you say, they're all over the place, they're not settled in one particular place, the main thing is to be there, to be present, and do what you can to show them that they're not left alone. I think this is one way of reminding them of the presence of God in the world through the church.
And a very warm thanks there to Archbishop Paul Saya, the Vicar General of the Maronite Patriarchate in Bikirke, Lebanon. Raising awareness about safety at sea. That's the theme of World Maritime Day 2012, celebrated on September 27th. Adding poignancy to the events, this year marks the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic. It is also the year in which the Italian cruise ship Costa Concordia ran aground off the Italian coast, killing at least 30 people. The Director of Development of the Apostleship of the Sea, Great Britain, John Green, explains that his Catholic ministry is cooperating with the London-based International Maritime Organization to promote good safety and good well-being for seafarers today. That's what the Apostleship of the Sea has been doing in countries across the globe since it was instituted by Blessed Pope John Paul II. As Green explains, those working in this Catholic ministry offer support to dockers and crews of merchant vessels at ports and for offshore gas and oil rigs and other seafarers. For many, he says, it's difficult to have access to pastoral care and support in their life of faith. He told me about how Catholic chaplains were on board the Costa Concordia and on the Titanic, and recounts their stories of heroism and spiritual support for anguished passengers.
The work of the Apostleship of the Sea, which is the Church's pastoral care for all the people of the sea, people who work in ports, people who work on merchant ships, and those indeed on cruise ships. We deploy onto these ships priests, usually from chaplaincies that are able to give us some time, so university chaplains or hospital chaplains, and they'll go on board for 2 or 3 weeks at a time, and we'll try and rotate a team of chaplains who may go on board. Primarily they'll come from the United States, Great Britain, Italy, Australia, and Singapore and Spain. Back in January, when the Costa Concordia had sank off the coast of Italy, there was an Apostleship of the Sea chaplain on board, Father Raffaele Molina. A very interesting story which really illustrates the work of cruise chaplains on board. He was a 70-year-old priest from Calabria in the south of Italy, and when he noticed that the disaster had struck, his first actions were he went to the chapel on board, consumed the Blessed Sacrament, and prayed then in a few moments that as few people as possible would lose their lives. He then stored some of the valuables that the crew had entrusted to him, and then he went straight away to assist the rest of the crew with the evacuation of the ship, because technically he is, as a chaplain, a member of the crew. It came out in the ensuing days, he was a little angry actually at some of the press reports that the crew had abandoned the ship quite quickly and weren't helping the passengers. He said this wasn't the case and that the crew themselves faced some serious dangers in quite a chaotic situation to help the others. They were trying to help the passengers get off the ship in as orderly a fashion as possible. Quite a difficult task. Father Molina himself stayed close to those who were injured, and also the local Apostleship of the Sea in the island nearby worked to receive the passengers and the crew and provide outreach in the local church. They opened up the parish hall there to provide hospitality and welcome and a word of comfort for all in this tragic situation.
And, of course, you're talking about a modern-day tragedy. But 100 years ago, the Titanic went down with three priests on board. Tell us a little bit about what we know about those three chaplains.
That's right. I mean, that's precisely the theme of the IMO's World Maritime Day this year, 100 years since the Titanic. There were, as you say, three priests on board. One in particular we know a bit more than the others, Father Thomas Biles. He was an English priest from Westminster Diocese here, and he was a parish priest at a town just outside London called Ongar. Very interesting life story. He was born in Leeds in 1870, and he was baptised by his father because his father was a Congregationalist minister. Anyway, as his studies progressed, Biles went to Oxford University, and there he began to be, he wasn't terribly convinced of the nonconformist position, and he began to be attracted to Anglo-Catholicism, and he decided to take up holy orders in the Church of England. But just before he was ordained deacon, his thinking had progressed further, and he was less convinced of the Anglican position. At the same time, his younger brother William had become a Catholic and he'd entered the Jesuits in Germany. And in their correspondence, we see some interesting discussion about religious matters and their own progressive conversion and journey of faith. In the end, his brother William decided against the religious life and emigrated to New York, where he went on to run a business there. Thomas Biles himself went on for ordination, having been received into the Catholic Church, and studied at Oscott College and finally at the Bader College in Rome. His brother William met an American lady, Catherine Russell, in New York, and they were engaged to be married. So naturally they asked their brother, Father Thomas, then, to officiate at the wedding. So he booked a ticket on another White Star liner, the Adriatic. However, at the last minute he was offered a place on the Titanic, which would get him to New York to his brother's wedding quicker. It's interesting that after the Titanic had gone down, his brother's wedding went ahead after the disaster. But straight after the wedding liturgy, he and his bride changed into mourning dress immediately, and then straight away they had a requiem mass for Father Biles. There's an interesting letter that survives about what were the last happenings of Father Biles on board. It said as soon as it became aware to everybody on board that there was an accident, Father Biles appeared on deck in his full clerical dress and moved about among the crowd, giving absolution to different groups and starting all the Catholics on the rosary. And real good descriptions of how he supported the crew. There was an interesting final account that there was a lady, Helen Mary Mocklear, and she said as she got into one of the lifeboats, which was one of the last to leave, as they were slowly going further and further away from the ship, she could distinctly hear the voice of the priest, Father Thomas, and the responses to his prayers. And as they became fainter and fainter, all she could hear was the refrain of the hymn, "Nearer, my God, to thee," and some of the screams of the people left behind. There were two other priests on board, as well as Father Thomas, although we know a good bit more about Father Thomas there. There was a Bavarian priest, Father Joseph Benedict Perisic, and a Lithuanian, Father Joachim Montvila. And I understand there's a movement for the beatification of Father Montvila because he was a Lithuanian priest who was emigrating to the United States because his ministry as a priest was being somewhat circumscribed by the Russian state at the time, who were occupying the area where he was ministering. None of these priests survived. They all went down with the ship, and there are all accounts that in these last moments They were very much ministering to the passengers. Also, in the days preceding, there were accounts that they celebrated masses, particularly with the crews in the second and third classes. And interestingly, providentially, one could say that because of their various language skills, Father Thomas being English, Father Benedict being German, and also knowing some of the surrounding languages there, and Father Montvilla from modern-day Lithuania, many of the passengers in the lower classes were migrating to the Americas. So they were able to celebrate masses and preach in a whole variety of languages. It was interesting that a report back saying that Father Thomas's last sermon was on the need for a spiritual lifeboat in the form of prayer and sacraments in case of spiritual shipwreck, and that was on the Sunday morning before later in that night the ship itself sank down. You could see the thread of providence bringing these three men really to help these people as they face this tragedy.
I'm getting goosebumps as you speak there, telling these stories. But how does the apostleship of the sea today, when we talk about ministry on board ships and so on, you do a lot of other things as well.
In addition to cruise ships, again, I think in 1990, Pope John Paul wrote a letter essentially structuring the work of the apostleship of the sea. And he said it was the ministry of the church to all the people of the sea. So it's the ministry to those people working in ports, dockers, those seafarers coming in on merchant ships, bringing so much of the goods that we use, the clothes we wear, much of it comes from overseas. I heard a fascinating little statistic from Great Britain that we here in Great Britain, we import more cake than we export. Amazing that the cheapness of shipping. So there's many, many people working on ships there. Also, that many thousands working in the fishing industry, not only in Northern Europe and in Americas, but huge numbers working in the Far East. And then also those working on offshore installations, gas rigs, oil rigs. And it's working not only to support their welfare, but also to support their faith, because for many of these people, it's very, very difficult for them to access pastoral care to be supported in their life of faith.
Now, if any of our listeners are thinking of going on a cruise, is there something they can do?
Absolutely. If they're thinking of going on a cruise, in advance of the cruise, do contact your cruise line and say, will there be a Catholic priest on board? Because I would very much like this. Obviously, the cruise line will be focused on services for passengers, so this will be of interest to them. But for the many thousands of crew on cruise ships, they will be working on 9 or 12 month contracts, and they often in port will be unable to get off and go to church. Certainly at sea they won't be able to. So the presence of a priest on board will be of great help to the crew. And indeed, if any priest is thinking of taking a cruise, it would be good, again, if they could contact their local apostleship of the sea, let them know they're going on a cruise, and it may be possible to make some contact with the ship's company to make it possible for them to celebrate Mass on board for the passengers and crew, and this would be hugely appreciated by the crew.
And a warm thanks there to John Green, the Director of Development of the Apostleship of the Sea, Great Britain. And that brings our program to a close today. Thank you for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.